Well, I mean, if they come after you, you know, you don't. Okay,
Like,
take my shoes, motherfuckers.
here's the $200 I have in my bank account right now if you want
I
it.
really doubt they're gonna do that.
All right, let's do our show. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Richard Wally, you are my co-host from Portland, Oregon.
And Cassidy Robinson, you are my co-host from the LA area.
And today we're going to be doing a show. I don't know why I've been doing that lately. Let me try that again.
We're going to be doing a show?
We're going to be doing a show. Today we're going to be reviewing Green Room and The Jungle Book. And at the end of the show, we're going to review the British comedy The Trip in our Netflix homework. Somebody did die over the week.
Oh yeah. I guess this. Well, I guess no. He revoked that. He is prince.
He is. Was.
Was. Yeah. Damn it.
For a while, he was the artist formerly known. I think he actually went back to prince pretty kind of a while ago. Like I think it was around like 99, 2000, 2001.
Oh, it couldn't have been. It was later because I was in Portland when he did.
When he went back to prince.
Yeah.
Because it was all had to do with like a legal thing. He was like stuck between a contract with his record
company,
label.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like a big F you to them to not have a name. But then when he got out from under that, he went back to Prince. Anyways, Prince died over the weekend.
He does have it. Yeah. The symbol. I always thought that was a humorous way to screw over. how do you label a symbol?
Right. And then he had all of his guitars made to look like it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was very convenient for him that his symbol was very guitar-friendly shaped.
Well, he had to have designed that.
Right. So that happened. I don't know. It's kind of strange. We've had all of these sort of like iconic rock people die
right.
in well, this one was especially weird because he wasn't that old and he wasn't sick.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he like had some issues like where he was feeling flu-like and he canceled a couple concerts, and then like a couple days later he even like performed one, and then a couple days later they just like found him dead in his apartment, age 50 something.
Yeah. I haven't they not like confirmed it yet? I haven't.
Yeah, they're still doing like
too much.
They were still like looking at the autopsies and that kind of stuff to see what the cause of death was. But of course I've already seen like YouTube videos like sort of on the side of my scrawler saying mm-hmm. it was an Illuminati conspiracy.
Oh, yeah, obviously. Is that the kind of stuff that they advertise to you? Because they're always trying to get me to watch, like super uber conservative videos.
Well, it doesn't take very long. Like, if you click on anything on YouTube, like, it takes 3 clicks to get to the Illuminati. Like, it's disturbing how big of a chunk of what's going on YouTube is crazy conspiracy theory nonsense that, you know, people who ignore all other kinds of media, which is most people who watch nothing but YouTube.
But they make badass murals.
Sure. What are you talking about? The Illuminati?
The Illuminati do. No. The people who do these conspiracy sites. Man, like one of them, I was like, I was looking for images. I don't know what I was looking an image for, but I stumbled on these murals and they were like of like this glowing evil Obama. And I was like, man. I mean, I don't agree with this, but man, that's a badass mural.
Got a good artist to work on that.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I saw that. I think it was just because I had clicked on a couple news stories to see what the cause of death was. And so then I started getting Prince everything. And one of them was some, I don't know, InfoWars or some bullshit. But I don't know. Yeah, kind of weird. I can't say that I was, like, ever, like, the biggest Prince fan. I couldn't tell you his entire catalog. I think I have his greatest hits on my Zune. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, you know, a song would pop up and I'd jam a little.
Right.
And I will say, though, and I said this at work the other day when we were listening to the radio, the death of iconic rock stars improves the radio for a couple days. Because... They have to pay some sort of lip service to it, so they end up hearing more songs by that artist that day. But, you know, he was kind of one of the... He's actually kind of a lot like David Bowie in that, like, he, like, spanned a lot of different genres, really rolled with the changes in pop culture, but never really, like, strayed from what he was, his own brand. Mm-hmm. You know, like, changed his image constantly. It was kind of chameleonic, sexually ambiguous, but also sort of a sex icon at the same time.
Well, yeah, but I'd also say that, you know, even though I wasn't a huge fan either, and I think the most things I've listened to is, like, the stuff from the Batman.
The Batman soundtrack. Well, I think for a lot of people our age, especially, that was probably their first encounter with him.
Right. I mean, that being said, like, I wouldn't ever be like, oh, he's, like, just doing it for the money, or it's just kind of like a show. Like, I genuinely think of him as, like, an artist and as, like, a... real music maker. So it is sad and it is weird with him and David Bowie, right? And kind of Lemmy was pretty close to that too.
In a certain kind of way, certainly. And, you know, yeah, unlike a lot of, like, the pop stars out there who may have been his contemporaries or whatever, or who, especially the ones who kind of jump around now, like, he wrote all of his own music. He wrote music that, like, I guess, like, he wrote, like, albums, because he was, you know, strange and kind of reclusive and whatever. He wrote, like, albums and albums and albums worth of stuff that'll never see the light of day. Like, he would just record entire albums, apparently, according to Kevin Smith, made entire music videos, like, huge productions that he just decided never to release. So, I'm sure we're going to have one of those, like, post-Tupac kind of things where, like, we get new albums every month from a dead artist.
When it's almost vaguely creepy.
Yeah.
I feel like you're being haunted by the ghost of Prince.
And he played he knew how to play, like, every instrument, like, well. Like, I posted a live clip of him playing Purple Rain. This is a song I kind of like. And the whole second half of it is just him soloing. And it's like, holy cow. Like, he never really got the credit for being a really good guitar player.
Right.
Like, a really good guitar player. Because this stuff, you know, was generally kind of pop music, but I have one kind of funny Prince story and then we can move on. I was at the mall a long time ago when I was, like, a kid. I was, like, 15, 14 years old, and I was sort of babysitting my two identical twin nephews who were, like, I don't know, 9 or 10 at the time, which is weird because now, like, one of them's married. We were at the mall and I was kind of walking them around and we passed, like, Fans or one of those stores. And they were playing Purple Rain or some footage of it on the TV screen. And I was kind of walking, not paying attention. And then, like, I didn't realize that my nephews weren't behind me anymore. And they were just doubled over laughing.
No.
And I was like, what is going on? They're, like, pointing at the screen, like, look at this guy.
Oh, right.
Because they'd just never seen Prince before. And I was like,
well, I mean, it is, like, sort of weird.
Yeah, that's it, Prince.
right. You know, no, Prince it is. He's a little bit of an eccentric, it's true, but, like, there isn't really those. Like, colorful characters had kind of, like, disappeared with the 80s in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think, like, the Katy Perry's and the Lady Gaga's and stuff. And even Miley Cyrus, to a certain extent, like, the sort of weird pop era that's going on now is trying to kind of supplant that, the sort of fashion thing. But, I mean, Lady Gaga performs her writes her own music, I think. But that's about it. The rest of it, I think, I feel so much more contrived and so much more disposable.
Right.
Like, there's not a lot of artistry behind it, but, you know, that's just me.
Yeah, I just mean there isn't. I mean, I don't feel like there's anything, like, that matches that sort of, like, Prince or, like...
David Bowie kind of thing.
David Bowie kind of, like, stylist.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because it's just...
Right. The music industry is so fractured and weird anyways right now that everybody, even no matter how popular you are, you're kind of playing towards a niche.
Right.
So, no, there's no, like, the artist. There's no, like, one... thing that sort of resonates in a big way anymore.
Right.
Because there's just so much noise in general. But let's get into it. Let's get into the movie news, because that's what we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'll start off with my first story, which I thought was vaguely amusing. We'll see how this works out. Studios are battling it out for the rights to make a live-action Pokemon movie. I guess there's a big bidding war right now, and they want to do this. It says here, the biggest push through is coming from Legendary Entertainment, which would serve as an interesting test case for the bearing of international tension on movie studio finances. Legendary acquired it back in January by Chinese real estate titan the Wanda Group, but tensions between Japan and China have been high for years. This is from the AV Club. With the larger country often refusing to allow Japanese films to be imported to the mainland. So this, yeah, because it's a foreign property, it's really tied up, and it's hard for anybody to get it right now. And, you know, Nintendo and all the people who are kind of involved with Pokemon are very protective of this property because it's kind of a cash cow.
Right. Well, it's also, I mean, it plays to a very specific audience.
Right.
Like, those games still...
They do super well. Like, the Pokemon, like, explosion of, like, you know, like, when South Park made fun of it is kind of over. But on a game level, they're still just as big as they ever were, if not bigger.
Right. And it's weird because, I mean, they've never been released on, like in a bigger format, like, on, like, an actual console.
Yeah, they never did.
It's like always been on DS. Console version,
yeah.
And honestly, for a film version, I could see this kind of being like as a like a kid's movie. I think it could be kind of fun, even though the premise is kind of, you know, monster dog fighting. the moral ethics of Pokemon is very...
It's weird.
It's dubious. Yeah. I mean, I'm totally stealing this from several people, but...
No, it's true. That's what it is.
But as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, shit, it is dubious. How can I support this? But...
Yeah, you know who would do a good version of this? I think, and if he was able to keep his tone and kind of play it tongue in cheek, sure. The one guy who did like the Shaolin Soccer movie,
sure,
and he did a little movie with a like a kid kind of a kid's movie with an alien in it. I forgot what it was called though.
No,
it was like one of his last movies. But even if he'd done it in kind of that style, it would have been kind of fun.
I thought about John M. Cho or...
Yeah.
Or the guys that did 21 Jump Street or something
like
that.
You just want them to do everything.
I do. They know what they're doing.
Phil Lord and Chris Miller?
I'm sure. I'm actually pretty sure that the studio system feels the same, so I revoke that one.
Right.
I take it back. I don't mean it.
Yeah. What was your first story?
My first story is about a little movie that did okay a couple of years ago called Jurassic World.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a second one, Jurassic World 2. We already knew that Colin Trevorrow, who did the first one, he wasn't going to be on again. He was actually going to, he's going to be on the new Star Wars film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a while since we've heard who was going to be in it. And so when it popped up, I was like, oh, yeah, that is a thing still. But it's going to be J.A. Boyana. He is a Spanish director.
Mm-hmm.
I know him best from The Orphanage. Some people might know him from a movie called The Impossible that starred Ewan McGregor about a giant wave.
A tsunami.
A tsunami, yeah. If you will.
And Naomi Watts. She was in that, too.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was about the big wave, though. I don't think it was about the characters. I haven't seen it. I'm just saying what I wanted the film to be about. But The Orphanage was it was like it had some creepy moments and definitely had some real atmosphere to the film. And
yeah, Guillermo del Toro produced that one, I believe.
Yeah, and it had a kind of methodical and slower pace. It was definitely not your like your popcorn kind of horror.
Yeah,
I mean, if they're kind of going that route and he's already done kind of an adventure film, I can kind of see why they're going to use him. I don't know what route they're going to go. If they're going to still keep it in a park, or are we talking about weaponized raptors? Or yeah. What are we going to be actually, seeing?
Like, if I read something a long time ago, I think the idea is now it's going to go outside of the park. It's going to literally be a Jurassic World. So, like, it could take place anywhere. Like, the creatures or... whatever they are now, these biological hybrid weird things, are going to be like going to like have escaped the park and are going to be like going places. Like
it's, also,
it's going to be a dinocalypse.
So they if they're going to go that far, I thought it was going to be more like they've had like other properties where they had like where like drug lords had purchased raptors right. and like
I mean I think. Like, it's going to, like, this is starting to become, like, the way the mythology is writing itself. It's starting to feel a lot more like the, like a Dark Horse expanded universe comic title.
Right.
Where it gets goofier and goofier and weirder and weirder, and then all of a sudden you have a crossover with Terminator and RoboCop.
It could. I don't know how they're going to do it. Like, it kind of made sense to weaponize them to me.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was still like, this is something I would have come up with when I was a kid.
Right.
I would have really loved. So, I mean, if that's what they're going for is like that audience, then it makes sense.
What I would like to see from this, which won't be what they do. Mm-hmm. I would like to see kind of a smaller scale thriller. You know, like maybe something kind of like in the ballpark of what Lost World like, Jurassic Park was trying to be. Like they sent a reconnaissance team to come check it out and then they just kind of get picked off.
See, my first image was like a Basic Instinct movie where Elena started falling in love with a raptor and then
the raptor's being interrogated and he like crosses his leg centrally.
Yeah. That was my first image, but you know, I can't be trusted with these kind of things. An eyeful raptor badge. yeah, exactly.
All right, my other.
Well, they're all females on the island, Cassidy.
It is
they're
true.
All females.
My other story: James Ponsoldt, the director of writer director of End of the Tour and The Spectacular Now, kind of a up and coming indie dude. Has just been put on a television show.
The film, I thought.
Is it a film? Let me see.
Is it James Ponsoldt?
Yeah. So. It's been set to direct a film about the first decade of MTV's launch in the 80s. And I feel like this is like kind of in the air right now. Like there's all this like talk about like, I don't know, the nostalgia of like the early days of MTV. Like they were going to make a show like this on HBO. That's why I thought originally it was a TV show.
Well, it kind of did. I mean, vinyl's happening. It predates MTV. It's more like 1970s.
1970s kind of record studio thing. Yeah.
I
think for whatever reason, there's a lot of buzz and interest about this topic right now. Mm-hmm. I like James Ponsoldt, so I'm interested in this because of that. I think he's an interesting guy, and I think he...
it's through A24, too.
A24 has been, doing a lot of interesting work lately as well. And because everything I've seen by him, The Spectacular Now, End of the Tour, are pretty intimate movies about very specific characters and very specific situations. These very small-scale, low-stakes kind of environments. And here he's telling kind of a bigger story, and he's going to have to paint with a slightly wider brush. And so I wonder how he's going to do that. I wonder, like, is he going to turn it into a character piece? Is there going to be, like, a one person, like Michael Nesbitt or something, and we look at the entire thing through? Or is it going to be, if it's a look at the decade, the first 10 years, you know, you really got to kind of move it along. You can't tell a story exactly that way. So I wonder how he's going to fit in with it, for one. And B, I'm just curious. I want to know how all of this shakes out. It is an interesting time. We were talking about Prince, obviously. He was a big part of the early days of MTV. And sort of what we were talking about, that iconic sort of image-oriented artist was sort of birthed by MTV.
Yeah.
Because the image became... When video killed the radio star. Which, ironically enough, was the first video that MTV played by the Buggles.
You're a weird encyclopedic pop culture thing. It's kind of freaky sometimes. You're like... I'm not trying
to
be
the Rain Man of music knowledge.
I was just about to say that, but I was going to say I'm not trying to be offensive. But it's not untrue.
I'm into it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, from the movies you've said, I can get behind the director and say, yeah, I'll take a look. Vinyl is more, I guess, kind of where I'm more interested when it comes to musical history.
But, are you into that show? I know a few people who are watching it. I was talking to a friend of the show, Keith Foster, and he's watching it because he watches everything on HBO.
As people should.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you do too, if you have it.
I kind of do too. Yeah. We get it.
And he said it was kind of trashy, but fun.
I don't know.
That's sort of how he described Ballers too, which I guess he's watching as well.
I wouldn't say it's like Ballers. I was going to try Ballers, but it's not like that. It is very much like trashy, like in the sense, like there's a lot of drugs and sex and like, but it's very much, I guess, in line with what you'd think the record company was kind of like, but it sort of has like, some people think it has poor pacing. I think that the show actually has just different. It's not TV pacing. It's like almost like movie pacing. Uh-huh. But like if you watched a like 12-hour movie,
right?
But it's very much about them, you know, music kind of transforming into what it has become modernly. You know, going from its fake kind of record industry into like punk and disco and rap and all those kind of things, and kind of opening up into the more modern music scene. So I find it pretty interesting so far.
Okay.
There is sort of a murder mystery element to it a little bit too, and a gangster kind of element. So I think that this first season has been interesting enough, but it's definitely kind of slower paced and a little different. It's not Game of Thrones. It's not somebody murdered like every 3 seconds. So
all right. Yeah, there was just a season opener of that, or a season closer, one or the other, of Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones just opened, yeah.
Right, yeah. My Facebook is blowing up about it.
Oh, well.
And I still don't care.
That's okay.
What's your next story? The last story.
My last story, I guess I'm doing the one about Joaquin Phoenix.
Sure.
Are we skipping over the Domhnall Gleeson one?
That's up to you. You can do one or the other.
Oh, man.
Which one's more interesting to you?
I always go funnier. What's more funny than interesting for me? Joaquin Phoenix is circling playing Jesus in a Mary Magdalene movie. Apparently, it's supposed to be authentic, according to the article. It's in quotation. It says authentic and humanist.
Right.
Portrait of one of the most enigmatic and misunderstood spiritual figures in history. I'm down. You know what? I like Joaquin Phoenix. I think he's a great actor. And I think that when he takes on a role, he does it.
Yeah, he puts it 110%.
As serious or not as serious as he needs to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm down. And honestly, I don't mind if they're kind of taking it in a different direction. And specifically if Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara are attached, and it's supposed to be a Garth Davis film. I don't really know much about him. But if it's supposed to be this kind of a story, it's not through some Bible Belt Christian movement kind of movie. Right. I'm actually a little bit more interested in it just to kind of see a different take. Because if you're bringing it into film land anyways, it's going to be more of a like a literary take and should be.
Mm.
So I think, and it's through the Weinstein Company. I think a lot of these kind of, he's been in pretty good roles lately.
Yeah.
And I think it would be interesting to see a humanistic
Jesus movie.
Authentic Jesus movie.
Jesus Mary Magdalene movie. Okay. This opens a lot of questions. Yes. I think what we're going to start seeing now, because there's been this rise recently of the faith-based films, I'm putting that in quotations, and in the last 2 or 3 years especially. Like, there used to be, like, there's always been kind of like a niche studio system out there. Like, you know, the LDS have kind of a lot of movies that they put out for their people, and then there's, you know, Christian movies that come out, like the Kirk Cameron joints and that kind of stuff, that come out like once or twice a year. But now we're starting to see these movies made by bigger directors, by actual studios with real movie stars. Mm-hmm. Like even that Heaven is for Real movie, I think that's what it was called. It had like Greg Kinnear in it. And then recently there was that one about the kid who falls off a tree. I'm not quite sure what was going on in that trailer with Jennifer Garner.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but go on.
Some kid had like a blood disease and then fell off a tree and became magically better. I don't know. But
is that faith-based?
Yeah.
Or is that just like weird? Okay.
It was like a God movie, but I don't remember what it was
like
called.
Like, was the ground God and it cured know. Him when he smacked? Okay.
The trailer,
I'm sorry. I know the way you're explaining it.
Go watch it.
Okay.
But anyway, so what I think we're going to start seeing now is kind of like what we saw with like Aronofsky's Moses or Noah, or like the Moses movie
Ridley
that
Scott's Moses.
Ridley Scott made. I think we're going to start seeing Bible-ish movies that are coming out of big studios that are not necessarily faith-based, but can bring in that audience. And I think that's going to start becoming more and more of a trend lately. It's kind of already started. And then
have
you get
any
people
of those done really that well, though? I thought that they weren't. I mean,
they haven't done fantastically. Some have done better than others. It's
well, the one thing about a Jesus movie, though, too, is the budget doesn't have to be huge.
Well, no, none of the especially for a story like this, or if it's just like a, I'm guessing, humanist drama between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, which I'll be interested to see what that take is, because some non-Bible scholar, like some, like, you know, people, I don't know, a lot of people like to like write their own slash fiction of what was going on there.
Sure.
Like,
there's
a lot of interpretations of like, were they actually a couple, and like the Bible just didn't want to go into that, or and so it'll be interesting to see if they go there, and, you know,
or if they were just bros. They're just going to be, it's going to be a movie about them hanging out and drinking.
Just chilling.
It's going to be like Dazed and Confused, but in Bible times.
Yeah, I would watch Linklater do a Bible movie about the 12 disciples.
Did you like my pitch?
Yeah.
You liked it? Okay.
I'm talking about philosophy of the future. But, you know, 2016, we still have a white Jesus, like super white, and Rooney Mara, super white. Taking place in the Middle East in the, prehistory.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Jesus would be like brown or olivey skinned, so.
Yeah, or possibly even darker if, you know, there's lots of theories about, you know, his
yeah, origins. The most recent one, I just read a thing about this because it popped up on the news feed.
Yeah.
But the most recent one that from genetic and from profiling, it would be somebody like from the area now. They'd probably look like, you know,
Middle East.
Somebody from Middle East, yeah, or something like that would be the most likely possibility.
I mean, you know, we're all used to it. It's just kind of what comes with the territory these days. I just think it's vaguely amusing that here we are and nobody's really pushing back on that at all. But yeah, we'll see. I like Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, that's kind of what I... for me, with some of those, sometimes I'm like, yeah, they definitely could have at least tried or at least pushed for some. There are enough people with enough acting talent, but
yeah.
And specifically, I'm like, he's a good actor. Why not? It's been done 1,000 other times. Why not?
There's a million white Jesus movies.
So it's a little hard to be like, okay, it's going to really hurt if we have one more. But
cinephiles should have a white Jesus section in their video store. I'm sure they do, actually. Okay, let's go ahead and get into our reviews. Do you want to start with Green Room or Jungle Book?
Maybe the Jungle Book. Let's do it in
release order?
Chronological order, yeah.
Okay, cool. Do you want to set up Jungle Book?
Sure. The Jungle Book is about, if you don't know, because if you don't know, then I don't know what's wrong with you. It's been in a book format. It's been in several different movie adaptations, including the most popular that this is kind of a remake of, the Jungle Book, the Disney cartoon.
From the 70s, yeah.
With such hits as Bare Necessities and I Want to Be Like You,
mm-hmm,
sung by an orangutan.
and a bear.
This follows. That's important. That's important, Cassidy.
It is. Believe me, I'm going to get into it.
This movie... is about Mowgli, mm-hmm, a young boy that's been kind of it's been adopted by wolves, and, you know, his parents are dead, and he's just this orphan that's been raised by the jungle and by the jungle ways. Basically, he becomes this questioned figure within the jungle's ranks because he's man. And because he's man, he doesn't belong there because of man's kind of proclivities in other parts of the forest.
Right.
So he has to go kind of go on the run from these different factions. Wow, this sounds like a political thriller, the way I'm explaining it. He has to go on the run from a tiger named Shere Khan.
Uh-huh.
And he's helped along the way by a black panther named Bagheera and a bear named Baloo.
Yep.
Now, this film, I have to say, I have a lot of nostalgia attached to this. Jungle Book was my favorite Disney movie ever. I still watch it, still like it.
Yeah, it's great.
Jungle Book, the Rudyard Kipling book, was the first book I ever read.
Oh, here. Really? I didn't know you read the book.
Like a full, like, well, yeah, but it was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like 7.
Right.
It was second grade, so... So, but this actual property has a lot of nostalgic and a lot of emotional weight to it.
Mm-hmm.
The movie itself, I kind of loved because of that.
Which the 2016 one?
This 2016 one, yeah.
Which Jon Favreau directed.
Which Jon Favreau directed, and definitely has his touch of humor and his actually, I think, kind of his way of kind of telling stories in a humorous kind of lighthearted manner.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked it. There was a lot of cool things. I actually wish I would have saw it in 3D. It has a really interesting depth of field that I think that you don't actually, when they talk about 3D, they actually usually don't do in most films. And I think this did.
Yeah.
It also brings in a lot of like color through the jungle itself. And these kind of the transitions actually do these like scenes where they focus on an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really beautifully rendered. And this is a animated film, really.
Yeah.
All of the characters are done through CG, but I think that they're beautifully rendered and they're relatable. And
you never get any kind of like weird uncanny valley creepiness.
Well, yeah. And you're never like, and you know that they're never putting like peanut butter in between the animal's gums to try to get it to move or anything silly like that.
Right.
So, but I think this is the first time that they could really like do it properly this way though, too. Mm-hmm. I think that the technology is where it is. And I think it was painstakingly taken to kind of develop this. This adaptation, it does borrow from the Disney film. It does borrow from the book. And from what I understand, they did kind of take some notes from Lion King as well.
Oh, yeah, they did.
And the thing about it is they kind of made an action adventure movie. It's still a family movie, but it's more in kind of, I almost like, I don't know, like the first thing that came to mind was like Swiss Family Robinson as opposed to like a straight up like
Disney musical.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I really enjoyed it. Again, it was pretty. I thought that it had a lot of, while it stroked some of the same strings as the original Disney, it still did its own thing. And I think it had a lot of heart and told this weird story about being an outsider in a system of laws. So what did you think?
I agree. I actually was surprised how acceptable this movie was.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I loved it. Like I didn't come out like with a big glowing heart, but I was watching it as like, okay, all right. I see what you're doing. I see what you're doing, movie.
And, well, I think Jon Favreau is sort of looked over a lot because of the types of films he's done and because they've been more mainstream. But I actually think he's a pretty decent like storyteller and director.
Yeah, like, I think he can get the job done. And I think even like his worst films, like maybe like Alien was a... Well, Cowboys and Aliens.
Yeah, I hadn't even seen that. So no, I guess I'm biased a little.
It wasn't a great film and there's had a lot of problems. But it wasn't a total wash either as far as just like an entertaining action blockbuster goes.
Sure.
This movie, I think it honors the Disney movie that it's based on.
That's a good way to say it.
Rather than just ripping it off. I felt like the beats change enough.
And the
dialogue isn't exactly the same. And the characterizations aren't exactly the same. lot of interesting voice talent here. We got Ben Kingsley, which is a perfect fit for Bagheera. I was like halfway through the movie, I forgot who was doing whose voices. And I was like, did they just get the guy who did it in the 60s? Because it sounds exactly the same.
Right.
Of course, you have Bill Murray doing Baloo, which is a really inspired fit. Idris Elba is a really, really intimidating Shere Khan.
Very much so.
And yes. Shere Khan is played the way they play him. You mentioned there's a lot of Lion King in this movie, and there certainly is. I feel like they kind of took the Lion King script and they took the Jungle Book script and just kind of meshed them together. So whatever story beats don't fit the original Jungle Book movie pretty much just comes from Lion King, which is fine. You know, that movie worked for a reason.
Yeah, I think that, again, it does it in a way where it makes sense for the movie, to me personally. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, that works. Like, I don't feel like it's overly treading on anybody's feet.
No. I mean, and it plays naturally. Scarlett Johansson does a voice of Ka, which was interesting. I would have liked to seen that scene go a little bit longer. I think there's an interesting kind of feel or beat going on there, and it kind of gets upended.
It was a lot creepier.
It was. Snakes are creepy.
Yeah.
I've
never been creeped out by a giant snake, and that was maybe the first time.
Good. I'm glad. You mean Anaconda with J-Lo and Ice Cube didn't destroy you as a child?
No. Well, that's not true. The only other time I was afraid of a snake in a movie was like, I believe it was Jackass 2. It was insane. They put Johnny Knoxville in a ball pit with two anacondas.
Yeah.
And his job was to get them out. That also frightened me a little because I'm like, you are an insane person. You should be eaten alive. Anyways.
And Christopher Walken does the voice of King Louis. As it went along, I found myself just kind of being romanced by it. I was a little thrown off originally by the talking wolves. I was it felt a little bit like Twilight territory.
The mechanics aren't of all the animals are on except I think the wolves. Like if you're talking about like the CG, like how their jaws move,
the mouths
is a little weird.
Move.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's like physically how a wolf's like
lips,
mouth moves
just,
and
they're
how
not
they're,
meant to talk.
They're not meant to talk. Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah. But bears totally are.
Bears and
and clearly
sure.
Monkeys, because they're just basically lesser evolved humans.
Right.
But yeah, no, I think, it plays naturally. The story follows its own kind of beats. Actually, the one thing it wasn't crazy about and really threw me out is when it specifically tried to play lip service to the cartoon, because the cartoon is a musical, and the cartoon moves like a musical. The songs push the story.
Sure.
This movie isn't, except for I think somebody somewhere in a high rise had a note that said, we gotta have Bare Necessities and we gotta have Be Like You. Because fans like that, and it's not gonna feel like Jungle Book without it. Even though those songs played in the original cartoon are there to serve the story, are there to push the story forward, and really are only exist in that movie because it exists in the format of a musical. In this, it feels like fan service at worst and really distracting and kind of awkward when it plays out in this. Like, at the end, I don't know how long you stayed in the credits, but there's a Scarlett Johansson cover of Trust in Me, which is actually like really smoky and cool and sounds like a Bond theme.
Right.
I actually would have liked that if the song maybe it just played some maybe in the background as a score rather than trying to integrate.
Oh, I mean, they did.
Yeah, it did. They did that as well. They integrated those songs in the musical themes. But I would have been, and rather than just breaking off into these musical moments that have nothing to do with how the rest of the movie's moving. Those moments in particular, I thought were really awkward. But other than that, I really enjoyed myself at this movie, and I think it is very well rendered. And it is, you know, mostly CGI environments. I think there's probably some amount of sets that are being used in actual like foliage and that kind of stuff. But
no, the only thing that they have, all of that is all of that's rendered. The only thing that they have physical is they have like a green screen where the kid runs around.
Right. How did you feel about the kid, Neil Sethi?
I was fine with him. I was actually really worried because I saw interviews with him.
Yeah.
Like talking like on like talk shows, and I was like, I don't know about that. But then I saw him in the movie. Like, no, he works. He's what Mowgli should be. So.
Yeah, I would say he was on about half the time. There were some times when I felt like a kid actor. And then there were some times where I was like, no, he's doing okay. And I could only imagine like a movie like this where he's essentially acting around, you know, ping pong balls.
What they did, I guess, is they got the Jim Henson Company to make puppets for him.
Yeah.
And basically they were standing behind and they were doing like little like voices. Puppet shows.
Right. Yeah. So no, he was just acting alongside puppets, which is,
I think it gives it an emotional weight because you can actually like perform with it. It was really brilliant. I actually thought for an idea, I was like, yeah, why don't they do that?
Yeah, they do that a little bit with adults too.
They should. No, I think that they should. Yeah. It's just because if you have something physical, you can at least make some kind of eye contact or kind of play with. I think it makes it a little easier than a tennis ball. But I mean, I didn't have as much trouble with the songs as you did. The only time it was slightly distracting was the King Louis one.
Yeah.
And that one, I got over it because he was menacing enough. He was played this weird like gangster orangutan.
Mm-hmm. Who's like gigantic. He's like, he's
that was also based on an ancient now extinct form of great ape.
Right.
The world is frightening, Cassidy. That's what I learned from this movie. The natural world is frightening.
Mm-hmm. It also decides to take a pretty big divergence from the original ending. And I feel like emotionally, the ending to the 60s or 70s Jungle Book makes more sense for the story and is a slightly more mature choice than this one, which kind of feels a little bit more like, which says everything about the two decades that these movies are released in, because I feel like the original ending to the Jungle Book, which is kind of like about moving on and about finding your place and about, you know, letting something go, if you love something, let it go kind of thing, which is all these kind of like hard adult truths to teach kids. Whereas the ending of this is just like party time. Woo. I love my friends.
Well, it might also be continuing. I mean,
right. Yeah. I mean, they might not want to close the book just yet.
Yeah. I don't think that they do. I personally was okay with most of it. I don't have nearly as many complaints, but again, I put a word of caution because I have like a blind child love for the Jungle Book, and this was a good adaptation. If it was bad, then it would have gone the other way and it would have poisoned the well, even if it was a mediocre movie.
Yeah, it could have tipped the other direction just as quickly.
Yeah. So I actually think this is really a, you know, as I've kind of gotten away from it, because it's been two or three weeks for me now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's enough time to process and kind of fill. And I think this is a deft adaptation. And you know what? I really do give Jon Favreau a lot of credit because I feel a lot of him in it.
Mm-hmm.
When I think about the other movies he's done, whether it's like the Iron Man films or Elf or Chef, or even if I'm thinking like Swingers or something really early.
Yeah.
I mean, he just wrote and acted in that, but he was definitely part of the DNA of it.
Sure.
I feel like you could watch all of those and be like, yeah, this is definitely part of that continuum. So I recommend it to a large swath of people, families and people who just kind of like the original. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I highly recommend it.
As far as these unnecessary Disney live action remakes go, I think this has been the best one I've seen so far by far.
Yeah.
And I think that,
I would say it's not unnecessary too.
Not as, however, there has been a live action Jungle Book in the past. You remember that one from the 90s with Cary Elwes?
I think that's the one. I think I loved it. I remember more the it was he like an evil colonist?
Yeah. That one was a lot. That one went a lot more into the post-colonial implications of the story.
Right. That it was supposed to be more the adaptation of the actual Jungle Book, but it kind of wasn't.
Yeah.
In the original book, Ka is actually like not really that much of a bad guy at all.
Mm.
He actually helps Mowgli rescue him from the monkey people. So, I mean, there's still a vastly different version of the Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That's what's good about some of those older adaptations that took a lot of liberties.
Yeah.
In the future, you can still take a lot of liberties with it, but you can also go back to the original and the traditional kind of story and pull from things. So it's kind of a mixture. I really enjoyed a lot of it, but
yeah. Yeah, I enjoyed this movie enough. I enjoyed it enough, I'll say that.
It was great. You're wrong. Anyways, right. Should we move on to our next film?
Yeah, let's get into Green Room. And this was a movie I think we were both really excited about. This is a smaller release from A24. We mentioned before has been, you know, kind of knocking it out of the park lately as far as these indie genre pieces.
Agreed.
And this is written and directed by Jeremy Saulnier, who did one of our favorite movies from year before last, Blue Ruin, a small kind of revenge thriller. And here he's kind of going more into kind of straight up horror territory with a story about a punk rock band, a kind of Virginia-based kind of Washington, D.C. punk rock band who's touring the South, and they kind of get stuck in the middle of nowhere without any gas money. They're siphoning their way through these cornfields, and they get in contact with a guy who does a radio show to get some money. They get put on the bill for a matinee in the middle of nowhere where they know they're going to be primarily playing to hardcore racists. which, if nobody knows anything about the hardcore punk community, that's kind of always been a faction of it. Like I said, like the YouTube community has a disturbing amount of conspiracy theorists. The punk community has always had a cross section of white supremacy going on with it.
And a big chunk, especially during the like hardcore era. Yeah.
Yeah. And to some extent, you know, that still kind of goes on with like the straight edgers and that kind of stuff. There's a violent, militant aspect to it.
Some of the hardcore. And, yeah. And it's weird because there are a lot of different,
the like, deeper you go underground. That. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so these guys are not like that, being from where they're from, and they decide they're going to buck against it a little bit. They, you know, they play the show. Hopefully they get their $300. They can get some gas money. They open their show with a cover of Dead Kennedys, Nazi Punks Fuck Off, which I liked.
Yeah.
I thought that was nice. That was a nice touch. We got some people who are sort of famous in here. Aaliyah Shawkat. I think a lot of people know her from Arrested Development. Anton Yelchin also plays in the band. Imogen Poots is in there, and most famously, Patrick Stewart, Professor X, and Jean-Luc Picard himself is playing the head of this neo-Nazi faction in the middle of nowhere. And an accident happens while their show is going on in their basement, in the basement of this club in the middle of nowhere. And they kind of get locked in their green room because they become witnesses to this murder that happens. And the police sort of get involved. All of these Nazis kind of start making all these plans behind closed doors of how they're going to take care of this and who's a witness, who isn't, who has the guns, who doesn't. And, you know, the tension just starts to ratchet up higher and higher as the stakes become deeper and deeper. It's a pretty violent movie. What did you think?
Well, my full thoughts are Jeremy Saulnier, when we first saw Blue Ruin, was a very, I had a very similar situation because when I first saw Blue Ruin, I was like, this is good, but I don't know how much I like it. And then as the more I got away from it, the more I realized how much I liked it.
Okay.
This film I think is very similar, and it's hard when you're watching it because it's so brutal. The violence that you almost kind of miss some of the like the techniques, the storytelling techniques, and how he's kind of twisting them, and how he's playing with you as an audience.
Right.
I dug this film. I really liked it. I wish I was like 16 or 17 because this would have like really, really been my jam. But yeah. I still liked it even as a 30-year-old. So it's still a good movie. This is definitely it definitely traverses horror. Really, like story wise, tonally it's horror, but story wise, it's like a shootout at the OK Corral.
A little bit, yeah.
It with tones of horror and the thriller genre. But if you're talking about the actual beats of the story, that's how it plays out to me.
Yeah.
So I don't know. This film was there should be kind of a warning to, I guess, if you're not a fan of excessive violence. This is a very violent film that really, I think, does the violence very well and very realistically. But if you don't like that sort of thing, you will not like this film at all. I personally was still very much fond. I was very still fond of the film and how it kind of plays out. He does really well in kind of the atmosphere and the mood of this film. I don't know if it moves. I don't know if the pacing is quite as good as Blue Ruin. I felt like there was like kind of times that this film kind of was a little bit lackadaisical.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I was tense throughout a good 2/3 of this film.
Okay.
Like, just like, oh my gosh, what are they doing? I also think he does this really interesting way of showing the violence to make it more brutal, because usually how they show it to you is they show you quickly and it's like cartoony. Mm-hmm. This one, it goes very quickly. You don't even see it. It goes to something else and then it goes right back in and focuses on the actual consequences of the violence and how horrible it is, which I haven't seen a whole lot. And it makes it very brutal. It just really, really focuses in on how real the situation is. I don't know. I like the cast of characters on both sides. They were equally menacing on the bad side and equally menacing on the good side. It did kind of play out in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
The performances were fun. It had some jokes that I kind of wish were punctuated maybe a little better, because
mm-hmm.
That would have, I think, helped the audience throughout the horror, or maybe not. Maybe it should just play as a horror film. I'm not really sure. That would definitely change it. I'm glad it ended the way it did, though.
Yeah, that was a nice beat. Yeah. I have to say this was a bit of a disappointment for me.
Okay.
I you know, especially coming off of Blue Ruin, which I really liked, and I thought showed a lot of promise from a new talent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that movie I felt was very airtight in the way that it was written and the way that it moved along. Like you said, the pacing was a lot. You know, that movie wasn't like a fast movie by any means. It took its time. But I felt like all the pieces were very strategically placed, whereas I felt like the writing in this movie, especially how the story plays out, is a little more loosey-goosey and a lot more kind of, in some places, kind of felt like it was making itself up as it went, like as a story. Like I had a hard time ever really getting behind what the tension of the situation is, which is basically these kids are locked in this room and they're afraid to leave because they're not sure who has, you know, what kind of ammunition on the other side of the door. But then there's all these moments throughout where I feel like the script just kind of loses itself, like where, you know, they could make their escape at this point, but for some reason they just don't, or the people who are supposed to be watching them could have.
What point? Just curious. I don't.
Like several times throughout the movie, there's these points where the people who are standing behind the door just leave, and they're not locked in. Exactly. They're kind of held in by their own fear. And they just go, like, they go outside to like have meetings or just start talking to people or talking to the police. And, you know, I understand it's a situation where people on both sides aren't sure who has what. And so, like you said, there is kind of like a Mexican standoff kind of thing going on between the two factions. But I don't. I feel like the way that it cross cuts between the two situations,
mm-hmm.
it breaks attention up in weird ways that I never really felt the effectiveness it should have as a thriller or as a horror film. And then by the second half of the movie, when they decide to make their escape and they decide they're just going to, you know, throw caution to the wind and survive as best as they can. to me, it got real schlocky, and it didn't whatever kind of seriousness or whatever kind of reality they were trying to build up to that point, I felt like kind of just went into, you know, boogeyman, guy behind the corner, you know, slasher movie zone. And I had unfortunately, I didn't really attach to any of these characters. Even in the beginning, like when we're first introduced to them and they're doing their like interview, I never really felt an authenticity from you know, their supposed punk backgrounds or like the way they talked to each other or about the music. Felt a little like somebody who did some Wikipedia research and then decided to write a movie about this kind of people. I never really got a feeling like these are real people in a real situation. I felt like the casting of the white supremacists were a little better than the band. Like, I think the idea of having Patrick Stewart kind of play a Nazi leader is sort of inspired and cool. I feel like as an actor, he's kind of wasted. Like, he doesn't really get a whole lot to do in this movie, and he's never really as intimidating as I hoped he would be in the role. He's really just kind of this guy in this shitty situation that he's trying to take care of, but they don't even really play that with a lot of pathos. Like, I don't know. I felt like there was a lot of places in this movie that there was a lot of great ideas going on and a lot of great setups for like a cool horror thriller, but it never really realizes any of those things because it's a little too concerned with getting to the next thing, or I don't even really know. Like the story just feels kind of all over the place and confused a lot of the times. And I never felt that deliberateness that made Blue Ruin so effective. Or even the humor. You know, you talked about this movie could have been funnier. Blue Ruin is not a laugh out loud comedy, but there's all of these great little situations with that main character where he's trying to figure things out as he's going. And it kind of creates this kind of nervous tension laughter. There's not even really that in this. It plays itself a lot more seriously, which then really kind of clangs against how schlocky it gets. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's a terrible movie, but
sounds like it.
I personally think it's a bad movie made by a really good filmmaker. I think it's a misfire. And I know that I'm in the minority in this. It has like an 87% on Rotten Tomato. Everybody seems to love it. I kind of don't get it. I went in, you know, really wanting to love it. This was, you know, that was.
I will agree it is not as good as Blue Ruin.
Yeah.
That I will agree to. I do think it does have pacing issues.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I don't see it. I mean, that's fine. That's your review. But personally, I think that the film I think it would play to a specific type of horror fan.
Yeah.
Outside of that, I don't know, just because of how brutal the film is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is definitely part of the effect. I also don't understand some of your storytelling stuff, because to me, that is exactly how it unplayed some of your criticisms. And them trying to escape. The characters that are like, we're going to absolutely do this. I'm going to make my break for it. It absolutely doesn't work for them. So I don't know. I don't see your review, but at the same time, I don't. If you want this to be Blue Ruin, it's not Blue Ruin.
I don't want this to be Blue Ruin. I just want it to be as well made as Blue Ruin. And
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to somebody, a hypothetical person.
Sure.
I understand your review.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think what I'm talking about is like there's a lot of places in the movie where I felt like certain characters, especially the people, the Nazis, who we know really just want to get rid of these guys. They're just, you know, they don't really want to make a deal. So this isn't the type of situation where things got out of control because they, you know, they could have made a deal and then decided not to. This was like they were going to kill these kids no matter what.
Mm-hmm,
and I felt absolutely. Like that they could have done that a lot quicker. You wouldn't have had a movie that would have been like 20 minutes in.
Well, they were trying not to draw attention. And at the time that they had a lot of people in the crowd that would have called, not everybody in the crowd was red laced, mm-hmm. which red lace means within that community means you've earned your stripes, so to say.
Right.
Meaning
right.
You've done something violent enough in order to be part of the trusted. This has a lot of crime elements and a lot of subtle little things like that, like the red laces, You learn later there's kind of a MacGuffin where you learn this, I guess, spoiler alert. There is kind of a that kind of shows you dividing up the faction within the actual like what white supremacists. And there are characters within the white supremacists that aren't that are red laced and aren't willing to go the distance. So think it's wrong. So I think it depends on your take on the story. I thought most of it had within the story context.
Mm-hmm.
It was believable. There was a lot of believability in it. Those are specifically more the ones that I guess I don't necessarily relate to your review with. But I mean, if you didn't find it believable, you didn't find it believable. So
yeah, I think that all the things that you're mentioning, those were factors that were being played into. But again, like I said, there's a lot of good ideas, a lot of interesting ideas, but none of them really realized to their full extent. I felt like a lot of these things that you're talking about, like all of these kind of factors that play into why certain people are making certain decisions, you know, I'm never really getting those conversations. Like a lot of it's just implied very quickly and then they move on to the next thing. I don't know. I won't say never see this movie, or I'd say if you saw Blue Ruin, you liked it, it's worth checking out, I guess. But I don't know. It just didn't do a lot for me. I saw that, you know, you mentioned OK Corral and that kind of stuff, and there's certainly a bit of that in there.
I think that's really the story beats, because it's not.
Yeah,
it doesn't play out like. Well, like, I mean, I guess you could argue more.
I felt like, a lot of like Straw Dogs and a lot of
Straw Dogs for sure. But I mean, that
and a lot of like Last House on the Left, like that early 70s savage cinema. Like I felt like that stylistically and story-wise is a little bit what he was kind of referring back to.
The Hills Have Eyes, but done realistically. Yeah,
that whole idea of like, you know, the hunter becomes the hunted or the hunted becomes a hunter and like who's really a good guy and a bad guy and violence begets violence and all of those kind of ideas. But
and it doesn't it, it never one other thing is like I don't think it ever says where it's set specifically, because they're in a cornfield, so that says the Midwest, and it also, but then the trees and all the communities, I've been around Oregon enough that I know that like that looks that's Oregon. And also I've seen in smaller communities like SS and that those kind of tattoos. So I kind of as I didn't assume.
Well, at some point they mentioned Portland, like they're on their way to Portland, so they could have been near that area.
Yeah. So I thought that they were more close to that range. I think this is really good. And if you're a horror fan that is into the type of horror that we've mentioned, like Last House on the Left, those kind of films, I think that this will appeal to you. And it is very, very well done for what it's trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
To the believability, we're just going to have to agree to disagree on that, because I really think that it pretty much makes sense. I mean, there are a lot of different characters that have different motivations and thinking, oh, one thing's like, oh, we can talk our way out. One, not sure, has no idea.
Sure.
And then one who thinks that the complete aggressive is the way to operate in the situation, which it doesn't work out for him very well.
Yeah.
I kind of like it. And I kind of like I like that you don't always understand like everything where it's going, and that it doesn't tell you everything, because it kind of leads you into an ambiguous situation. But by the end, I pretty much understood all of those factors. It was all, none of it was about race. It was all about, the green room, as we could say,
right?
To not spoil it.
Yeah, I mean,
spoiled it though by saying it that way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, given the fact that it could be a very politically charged kind of thing, given the situation they put it in, it never really does become that, which is fine. I actually think that was one of the better decisions the movie made. Yeah, I don't know. I just wasn't into it. About the middle of it, I kind of got a vibe for what I thought it was, and I was like, oh, okay, this is like a slightly artier version of The Purge.
Oh, you're not wrong. But I like The Purge, so I mean, you're talking to the wrong person. Like, I think that The Purge has some really cool things, and it is like popcorn horror adventure. But
yeah,
I think this thing does some. I think both films have some merit inside their own proper genres and what they are, as opposed to, I don't know.
Right.
So we're just going to have to disagree. I think that if you are a horror fan, though, you should go see this. Like, if you're of this type of horror, if you're like just into like Paranormal Activity and Conjuring, where not bad things happen to people, then yeah. You should just avoid horror in general.
Let's get into our Netflix homework, which I assigned you a couple weeks ago. This is Michael Winterbottom's The Trip, which I did look into because I was confused before. It was originally like an eight-part miniseries, mm-hmm. and they whittled it down, a version of it down, to this 2-hour movie, which is what we saw.
Right. Doesn't really matter.
Okay.
I mean, it's pretty simple. It's about two friends who... I guess friends that haven't been very close for a while,
mm-hmm.
they go on a road trip because one of the characters who had this planned trip with this kind of romantic partner, it kind of fell through and he still had all of it and he felt like he needed to go on it regardless. And so, and they're at very different points in their life and they kind of have this weird competitive thing. One's doing very well in his doing fairly okay in his career, while the other one isn't, but the other one's succeeding in his family life versus. And so you kind of see them kind of rekindle their friendship and kind of also kind of play out these different, just their different neuroses and stuff throughout the trip.
Yeah.
This film, it was a road film.
Road comedy
between two friends. It's pretty tried and true. It kind of actually reminded me of like an English BBC version of like a mumblecore film.
In some ways. Yeah. And I think there were, you know, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon are the people in the movie and they're essentially playing themselves or a version of themselves.
Probably a heightened reality.
I would imagine kind of like playing their neuroses to the max. And I would imagine since they're both actors and comedians and probably friends that there was a decent amount of, improvisation going on here.
For sure.
And I think a lot of these scenes, which deals with kind of them sort of doing this one-upping of each other and, you know, a lot of impressions going on in this movie.
Yeah. Maybe a little too much for my taste, to be honest.
Maybe a little too much. But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of that stuff was probably off the cuff. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see how this played as an 8-hour miniseries.
Agreed. I would be more interested in that. I think that this kind of I didn't see a whole lot that I haven't seen in another type of road trip comedy.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say I don't recommend it because I think that the certain person that would like this type, like kind of those road trip kind of comedies and wants to see something like that might enjoy it. This is a little bit more of like an, I would say like a little bit more maybe arty. I don't know. It's not as broad of a comedy, I guess I should, is the best way I can say that.
More naturalistic.
For me, it didn't really do much. I was kind of, honestly, I was a little bored watching it. I mean, the kind of like characterization between the two and their kind of like internal conflicts with each other was more interesting to me than the actual necessarily anything going on in the film. Their positions were so stereotypical that it was hard for me to take serious sometimes, or not necessarily take serious, but to relate to. There didn't seem like there was like this specific. And I think maybe a TV show would be better because you would get into some of those specifics. There were just things that felt left off from this film. So I casually recommend it to people, especially if you're kind of an Anglophile and you like road comedies. It didn't do much for me. So
yeah, I enjoyed it enough. I mean, just based on the chemistry between the actors and liking the actors, and I will say that as a story, it doesn't really do a whole lot. I mean, there is a basic kind of thing here about them being in two different stations in their life and sort of appreciating where you are and the grass is always greener and career aspirations and like, you know, setting your goals in certain places and being of a certain age and all of these things that are kind of playing in, maybe sometimes subtly, sometimes not. I think that all plays okay, the story stuff, but, you know, it is pretty episodic because it is based on episodic television, and so the way it's whittled down here, you kind of feel it doesn't really, it doesn't really crescendo in any sort of way. It just kind of goes until it stops.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a little bit of, you know, I don't know. There's little markers in the movie of who's experiencing what at what time.
It just felt like I think that this would play out better as the miniseries as opposed to the
right
as to the film personally. And so that, and I mean, and I learned that post. I mean, pre knowing that it was a miniseries first, I still kind of felt like it was a little bit like there weren't some specifics that were nailed down.
Mm-hmm.
And about the characters or about the situation that and not even, I don't mean like I wasn't like clear on what was happening. It's just more like for the sake of the story, there'd be some kind of like characterization, like nuance kind of like about the character that you go, oh, that's the kind of person they are.
Right. I felt like that I got that enough, especially with the way that they talked to Rob talked to his wife and Steve talked to his girlfriend. I think like I got a good idea of who they were as people or who these characters were.
And in those situations a little more, sure.
Yeah. And I think that I laughed enough. You know, there's good, witty British dialogue going throughout. And the improvisation stuff, sometimes it gets a little obnoxious, but sometimes it's pretty funny. And I think as a comedy, it worked fine enough for me. I've seen a lot of movies like this. Actually, End of the Tour came to mind. That one's a little bit more serious and has maybe a slightly more of a point to it. But I would say that I enjoyed it about at that level.
I probably enjoyed End of Tour more. I felt like this was a little bit too meandering for me.
Mm-hmm. A lot of food.
And I just kind of thought once I found out it was a miniseries, I was like, I wish I just watched this as a miniseries.
I'd be interested to see how A Trip to Italy plays, because that was written to be a movie.
As opposed, that might be different.
As opposed to this one, which was whittled down. So, yeah, I don't know. I mildly recommend it, especially for fans of British comedy. I think our friend Hillary would love it. And
I think he's probably seen it
and has already memorized it.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't like your Monty Python type humor, though.
No. It's not absurdist, but it has that. It's very dry, British, high, stiff upper lip kind of stuff.
Yeah. It depends on, like, In the Loop, I would say, is more of like a... It's not that political. It's not that, but that type of witticisms,
right,
is at the level. I recommend it to people who, if the things we described are movies you usually like, then yes. If you're more of, you know, you want something with a little bit more action or whatever, then I mean, obviously, this isn't going to appeal to you.
Yeah.
So. But I guess I mildly but less than Cassidy recommend this.
Okay. I like that as a standard.
Yeah.
Okay. One last thing and then we got to go.
Yeah. You got to go.
I got to go.
You need to run.
I got to go to work. But we got a letter from Patrick. He sent this a couple weeks ago. I'm going to read it off real quick and give a couple thoughts. And then I'm probably just going to record the last bit by myself.
Might as well. I thought you'd do this by yourself, too.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Okay. It says, hey, fellas. Great past few shows, but I'm going to focus on episode 168. On the TV talk in American Idol, my parents are in their mid-60s, and they could cut the TV cord way back to... they cut the TV cord way back when TiVo first came out. My dad, for as much of a Luddite as he watches every show recorded or through Netflix since 2004. So, you know, there's that. Richard, you were dead on, right about Midnight Special, being Starman-ish. And if you listen to Almost Educational, we share a love for armchair philosophy, that are bantered about in films like this.
I've got to pause you for right there. I know he's giving me shit, but I already sent my rebuttal to him and he knows how I feel.
Okay.
Go on.
Cassidy, did not see the E.T. parallel until you brought it up. And yep, Nichols is an early Spielberg-era devotee. I have a theory on the recurrence of making fairy tales and making a female protagonist characters taking center stage in pop culture junk from Star Wars to Hunger Games. At first, my liberal knee-jerk reaction was, oh, this is great now to see girls see themselves in their hero. But my deeper, darker liberal knee-jerk reaction kicked in when shopping the toy aisle this winter for my nephew. Disney, movie studios, Hasbro, and etc. do not give a shit about empowering females. They just want to sell as much crap to both sexes as possible. Disney, for the longest time, wanted to make the boy market in terms of toys and settled for princesses. Now, with Fairy Tale Queens and Rey from Star Wars, they can just sell toys to everyone. There are no more boys or girls sections in the toy aisles, but just one massive capitalist money shot for toys. Toys for all sexes, toys and plushes and candy bars. They market to all children. It is just a big progressive gender-neutral blah blah wrapper covering another toy that promotes more mindless consumerism. Also, Adam Driver is legit. He impressed me again in this flick. I agree. Going back to a Midnight Special. Sorry for a rambling. Edit however you wish. All right, cool. We didn't edit it,
by the way.
I did a little bit. I agree with the premise that a lot of this gender neutral stuff has more to do with making money than being inclusive. But you know, you take what you can get, I guess, in some cases.
Well, I think that there is a positive behind all of that the corporations latched on to, but that's always going to happen.
Right.
Like, I don't think that we should stop making empowering films about young women by any means. I think that we should continue to do both of each sex, of each race, of each, you know, all of that. I think that there is a place in the world for all of it. So while I agree with the corporatism of it, and I mean, but at the same time, from a more realistic position, I don't think it would be different, no matter what it was.
Right. Yeah.
And Disney has wanted the market on all toys. And now they do. They have Marvel, they have Disney princesses, and they have gender neutrality. Right. So they have the target audience that they want everything. So I don't completely disagree with you, but at the same time, yeah, I think that they should still make strong female lead characters. I would argue I like it more when it's like Firefly as opposed to Hunger Games, because I feel like Firefly
is more
of like,
kind of a mixed group kind of thing.
Well, it's mixed, and there's different types of females. You don't have to just be one strong female. Like, you can have different types of strength within the female community, whether it's smarts, actual like being able to shoot somebody in the face, or you know, be able to like reason and talk with people. So that's my take.
Yeah, I agree. But if you want to email any of your thoughts to us, you can do that at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/JabberPodcast. Our Twitter is @JabberPodcast, and I can respond to you there. We're also available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Podbean is our main archives, jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. We're also available at the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast and Player.fm. Read my reviews at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I have some reviews up over at the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Go ahead and check out Brad's new webzine that he does over medium.com/panel-frame. He's still posting like two or three stories about every day. He has a lot of contributors that he's met both in person and online. And there's, you know, comics, articles, deconstructions, criticisms, all sorts of stuff about entertainment. Also be sure to check out Leland over at his podcast in Olympia, Washington, dampercast.com. Check out Rod and Denise of their music podcast, The Listening Party. And also check out Patrick at his podcast, Almost Educational, that he does with his teacher friend Dennis, and Make Dad Read Comics that he does with his dad. Until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.